Welcome to Mentioned in Dispatches, the podcast from the Western Front Association, with me, Dr. Tom Thorpe. The WFA is the UK's largest Great War History Society. We are dedicated to furthering understanding of the First World War and have around 6,000 members worldwide. For more information, visit our website at westernfrontassociation.com. It is the 15th of September, 2024, and this is episode 341. On this week's Dispatches podcast, I talk to historian Dr. Brian Hall about his research into the overlooked experiences of the 325th Field Signal Battalion, the first black signal unit of the US Army, which is part of the American Expeditionary Force during the Great War. His work highlights the battalion's contributions and the challenges they faced within the racially prejudiced military environment in which they served. He argues that their technical proficiency and combat service challenged racial stereotypes at the time and contributed to the broader struggle for civil rights in the United States. Brian spoke to me from his office at the University of Salford in Greater Manchester.
Brian, welcome to the Dispatches podcast, or welcome back, I should say. Could you start by telling us briefly about yourself and how you became interested in the experiences of African-American signalers during the Great War?
Well, thank you for having me back on to do this. Sure. Well, as a historian of the First World War, as a military historian of the First World War, I've begun to sort of switch my focus from the British Army to the American Army. And I suppose this research on the African American signalers is an offshoot of a much larger project that seeks to reassess American military operations during the first through the lens of its communications experiences. I actually came across a photograph of a group of African American signalers stringing telephone lines in the Meuse-Argonne sector of the Western Front in October of 1918. I came across the picture in the US Army Signal Corps history about 4 years ago now, when we were in the midst of the very first wave of the pandemic. And it just aroused my curiosity. When I learned that this was the first and only black signal unit in the US Army during the First World War, and I wanted to know more about it. And I was amazed, although surprised and delighted in equal amount, when I found that nobody really had looked at the 325th Field Signal Battalion and assessed its experiences during the war and what happened to the signalers after the war itself. So I felt obliged, really, to sort of fill in the blanks, so to speak.
So before we get on to the 325th Field Signal Battalion, could you tell us what a Field Signal Battalion is in the context of the American regimental structure? So how did they fit into an American division and regiment and battalion?
Sure. Well, a Field Signal Battalion is responsible for maintaining communications between division and regimental headquarters. So every American division during the First World War had a Field Signal Battalion. Now, initially, Field Signal Battalion would comprise about 240 officers and men. That was the size of a Field Signal Battalion upon the outbreak of the war. But of course, what happens is the Americans decide to go for these mammoth sized divisions, about 28,000 strong, about twice the size of your standard European division at the time. So that of course, entailed a significant enlargement of the Field Signal Battalion itself to about somewhere around about 450 officers and men. That is essentially what a Field Signal Battalion does. I should say, you also have telegraph battalions. They're responsible for the communications, sort of, if you like, from the the bases on the coast right the way through to sort of divisional headquarters. But divisional headquarters forward, that's the responsibility of a field signal battalion.
Now, would I assume that the members of the Field Signal Battalion would be attached to, say, regimental HQ, battalion HQs, but they belong to a separate unit, but would be attached as part of a headquarters unit, or would they sort of just come in and do a job and go away?
Yeah, no, they would be. I mean, a field signal battalion typically comprised of a headquarters component, and you'd have three chief companies here, A, B, and C. A company and B company would be responsible for radio and for line-based communications, and then C company, which was the outpost company, they would be the furthest forward, if you like, of the members of the field signal battalion. So they'd be right up at regimental headquarters, helping to sort of maintain, repair the communications, the furthest extent of their official reach anyway.
So let's start at the beginning. So April 1917, America declares war, and we see a massive expansion of the American deployment to Europe, which is the American Expeditionary Force. Now, could you start by telling us how the 325th Field Signal Battalion was formed and the unique challenges faced by it actually recruiting the members of the unit?
Well, I think to sort of get our heads around this, I think a few important contextual points. I mean, firstly, is the fact that racial discrimination, prejudice, and segregation was deeply ingrained within American politics and society in 1970, and those prevailing attitudes were mirrored in the policies and the outlook of the U.S. Army. I mean, there were very limited opportunities for Black Americans to serve in the US Army in the early 20th century. Give you one example. I think of about 27 African American men who were sent to the to West Point between sort of 1870 and 1917. Only three were awarded commissions. And African Americans were virtually excluded from all of the technical, the specialized branches of the army, so the artillery, the engineers, and of course the signal corps. So, as you can imagine, Woodrow Wilson, the U.S. president's decision to include African Americans, the draft, which was sort of first announced in May of 1970, was deeply controversial. So, not wishing to incite a race riot while attempting to mobilize the country for war. The US War Department decides eventually to establish two African American divisions. The 92nd Division would be formed mainly from Black draftees, while the 93rd Division would consist predominantly of Black National Guard units. All officers sort of holding the rank of major and above were white, although Black junior officers were initially allowed, but only to serve within the infantry because African Americans were unsuitable to serve as officers in technical branches. So the 93rd Division is shipped off to Europe very quickly. I should say the 93rd Division consists of four infantry regiments only. It doesn't have any of the additional divisional support units. And once the 93rd arrives in France, the commander of the American Expedition, John Pershing, hands the 93rd Division over to the French, where they stay with and they fight with distinction for the remainder of the war. The Harlem Hellfighters of the 69th Infantry Regiment, perhaps the most unit there. Now, interestingly, Pershing also attempts to get rid of the 92nd Division. He actually asks the British if they would have the 92nd, but the British, the War Office in London, flatly refuses. Thus, the 92nd serves firmly under American command, and as a fully fledged division, it obviously has to it comes complete with supporting units, including a field signal battalion. It's assigned a chief signal officer. The 92nd Division's chief signal officer is Lieutenant Colonel Thomas Spencer. Spencer is actually an infantryman by trade, Although after the war, he does transfer over to the Signal Corps permanently. And Spencer is instrumental in actually putting in putting the battalion together from absolute scratch. He personally tours African American schools and colleges across the country in the autumn of 1917, including, of course, the most famous, which would be the Tuskegee Institute in Alabama. And he enlists as many suitably qualified officers and men as he possibly can. This is a monumental task, of course, because opportunities for African Americans to enter the electrical engineering profession are few and far between in the early 20th. But nevertheless, from the limited pool that he has, he's able to procure the talents of a number of men who possessed either electrical engineering qualifications or practical experience. My research has also found that many other recruits, even if they didn't have electrical engineering qualifications, they were nonetheless college educated. So in that sense, the 325th Field Signal Battalion was handpicked, which made it very different to much of the rest of the 92nd Division. It was also unique in that the battalion commissioned black officers who did see active combat. Again, my research has found that of the 15 officers of the battalion, 8 were African Americans, and all of them had a combination of either pre-war electrical engineering qualifications or practical experience, or they were at least college educated. So that's how the battalion sort of comes together, in your liking.
So is this a draftee unit or are these men volunteers?
These men are how can I put it? They are well, they're not requested, but Spencer in particular actually encourages many of them to enlist in the battalion. Obviously, he doesn't do that for all of them, but many of them are sort of encouraged to sign up specifically to the battalion, beginning in late 1917. Homer Roberts, for instance, he's one of the first to sign up and to the battalion, and he becomes the first African American given a commission in the U.S. Army Signal Corps, and he stays with the Signal Battalion throughout the entirety of the war. So the vast majority are encouraged and to join because they possess some sort of experience or some sort of practical skills that are related to the trade. Although I have to say there are some. Invariably, there are some draftees who do join the battalion who possess, who aren't either college educated or who don't possess skills and experiences. But they are very much in the minority.
So a lot of these people have been working, putting in networks, exchanges, and things like this as the sort of telephone network expands across the United States in the early 20th century.
To some extent, yes, but it's more local level. Because of course, how closed off the profession was for African Americans at the time, given the racism, the prejudice that they encountered. So many of them would have gained experience, would have got qualifications from particular black schools and colleges, and would have worked on a small scale. So in that sense, their experiences, their skills were limited. They were constrained to somewhat, somewhat. Whereas, the field signal battalions for the other divisions, they're able to sort of tap into larger telecommunications industry, of which white men predominantly would have been the main workers. They have an advantage, so to speak, over the 3rd Battalion, definitely.
Which brings us nicely onto the next question, which looks at training. So the unit is formed. Now, what specific training challenges did the battalion face when they were located at Camp Sherman? And how did the racial discrimination of the time impact on their preparation for active service?
Okay, so sure. So the War Department orders the construction of about 32 training camps across the country in May, June of 1917 to sort of cope with the influx of recruits. Now, unlike other National Army sort of divisions, the units of the 92nd Division were scattered among several camps, mainly to sort of appease white supremacists who were concerned that concentrating too many Americans in one camp was dangerous. So the 325th Field Signal Battalion finds itself in Camp Sherman in Ohio during the first half of 1918. But it never gets the opportunity to work with the rest of the 92nd Division before setting sail for France in June of 1918. Something, of course, that was going to prove a major detriment to its preparations. When you think about, a signal unit, its primary purpose is to ensure that all the various bits and pieces of the division are connected and that they're coordinated, that they work together. Well, it doesn't get any opportunity to do that prior to the prior to landing in France. But what's also sort of compounding the situation, and this is a situation faced by every US Army division at the time, is that the training itself is rushed, and it's rushed because primarily because of the urgency that's created by the German offensives of 1918, and the demand to get the Americans across the Atlantic as quickly as possible. Yeah, so the training undertaken by the recruits of the 325th Field Signal Battalion was also hampered by shortage of specialist technical equipment, such as radios and portable telephone sets. These, of course, have been developed by the British, the French, the Germans, of course, during the last 3 years of the fighting on the Western Front. But the Americans are essentially 3 years behind here, so they don't get. And it's not just the 325th Field Signal Battalion; it's all field signal battalions. They just don't get the opportunity to train with the specialist equipment that they would eventually find themselves possessing once they get to Europe. So that also massively hampers the battalion's preparations.
So, how did the battalion's role in handling communications technologies, many of which were, really modern and cutting edge, challenge the traditional racial boundaries within the US Army?
Well, like other technical branches of the US Army, the Signal Corps was practically off limits to African Americans before 19. And I think a good way of sort of illustrating this is by just bringing up the case of William H. Green, who was the first African American to be admitted into the Signal Corps. Now, Green was a graduate of City College in New York, and he had to jump through all sorts of hoops and even get the approval of the U.S. Secretary of War, Robert T. Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln's son, in 1884, to force the Signal Corps to allow him to sit the competitive Signal Corps entrance examination. Now, he passes it, he scores very highly on it, and he subsequently completes his course of instruction with the Signal Corps. But his time in the Corps lasts only 3 years. In 1887, he is discharged in without any proper explanation, without character, undisclosed offences. It's very dodgy sort of stuff. And despite setting a precedent, Green's entry doesn't result in a wave of African Americans being admitted into the Signal Corps. This is a white soldier's speciality. It really is. And I should say that there are approximately 200,000 African Americans who serve in Europe during World War. Of that number, about 80% do so in they do so in stevedore units, labor battalions, salvage companies. Essentially, they're given shovels and picks, not rifles. Really, the battalion, the raising of a battalion of black signalers goes against the very grain established army and signal corps practices.
So let's talk about their deployment to Europe. Tell us briefly about what they did, where they served, and what their contribution was in the various campaigns that the IEF fought in 1917 and 1918.
Sure. Well, they set sail for France in June of 1918, and they spend much of July and August, either training or holding quiet sectors of the front and sort of getting their first sort of experiences of life, trying to maintain community in trench warfare. The battalion accompanies the 92nd Division then to the Meuse-Argonne at the end of September 1918. Now, the Meuse-Argonne, of course, is the largest and bloodiest US military operation of the war, and it's the American Expeditionary Force's main contribution to the Allied offensives that eventually forced the Germans to request an armistice. Now, the 92nd Division is held in reserve, but for some reason, and I still don't know why this was the case, the 368th Infantry Regiment is detached and it joins the French 11th Cuirassiers to form a Franco-American liaison force whose chief purpose really is to ensure that contact between the US First Army and the French Fourth Army to its left is maintained throughout the attack. So within the sort of the historiography, the general consensus is that this liaison force, this mixture of the 368th Infantry Regiment and the 11th Cuirassiers, it fails. But the reasons for that failure are a big source of contention. Now, at the time, the white officers of the 92nd Division and the AEF High Command blamed the black officers and men of the 368th Infantry Regiment, calling them cowards, incompetent. But of course, black soldiers and officers at the time, and I should say historians since, have offered far more convincing explanations, drawing attention to things like adverse terrain and inadequate resources, and crucially, the poor leadership of the regiment's white officers. Now, where the 325th Field Signal Battalion come in here is that a platoon from the 325th Field Signal Battalion was actually attached to the 368th Infantry Regiment. And its role really was to sort of help facilitate communications, both, if you like, vertically and laterally as well, ensuring that communication between the 11th Cuirassiers, if you like, on the left, was maintained with the American 77th Division on the right. Now, my research has shown that communications do break down at certain moments. The battle begins on the 26th of September. And actually, to begin with, the battalion does pretty well in sort of maintaining the liaison between the Americans and the French. Very quickly, however, as with all First World War battles, communications begin to break down, and they're not really fully established until the end of September, beginning of October. Now, in the historiography, it's as if there's a communication blackout from day one, and it's an absolute disaster. My research has sort of shown that actually that wasn't the case. Communication was intermittent, if you want to call it that, but it was never completely lost. And what I've been able to find out is that actually the battalion and the 368th Infantry Regiment weren't solely to blame for the lapses. American doctrine at the time actually stated that it was the responsibility of the unit on the right to ensure that it had communication with the unit on its left. Thus, the 77th Division, actually was responsible for much of that. It doesn't completely absolve the 368th Infantry Regiment for what happens, but nonetheless, what is interesting is that nowhere in the post-battle sort of analyses and the reports of the American High Command is there any sort of acknowledgement of the 77th Division's responsibility for maintaining communications with the Franco-American liaison force. It's all pinned on the African Americans, on the 368th Infantry Regiment, and of course on the 325th Field Signal Battalion, who've let communications supposedly fall to pieces in the Argonne Forest. And what's ironic here is when you look at what's happening elsewhere during the Meuse-Argonne campaign, particularly the opening couple of weeks, communications break down left, right, and center. The 325th Field Signal Battalion's experiences in the Meuse-Argonne are not unique, but the Americans don't acknowledge that. The American High Command, chooses to see it for what they see it as, is that is the incompetence of African American signalers, the incompetence of African American officers and soldiers. But obviously, turning a blind eye to the fact that Every other American unit across the line also was in a communication blackout. And this just shows the level of prejudice that was involved in assessing the battalion and what happened in the Meuse-Argonne. What the Americans also don't do, the American High Command also doesn't do, certainly after the war, is then it then talks about what the battalion goes on to do in November of 1918. Shortly before the armistice is signed, the American Second Army launches the first of a series of attacks towards the German fortress of Metz. It begins on the 10th of November, and although the armistice comes into effect, just over 24 hours after the attack is launched, the 92nd Division actually achieves all of its initial objectives, and one regiment, the 365th, advances about 3 kilometers, which is the most notable accomplishment of any unit in the in Second Army. And of course, the 325th Field Signal Battalion plays a big part in ensuring that this is a successful. It benefits from a month of intensive training prior to the attack. It manages to establish an intricate system of visual signaling stations, carrier pigeons, aircraft employing visual signals and radio to facilitate communication between the artillery. It ensures that telephone lines accompanying the advancing infantry are successfully laid and repaired while under heavy shell fire, and that runners, carrying written or verbal messages are able to perform, heroic acts in order to ensure that the timely delivery of important tactical information. So the battalion plays a really important part in this success. But of course, the Army High Command doesn't want to dwell on this at all. It's far more interested in highlighting the failings of what happens in the Meuse-Argonne, and instead it downplays the events of the 10th and the 11th of November as what it characterizes as operations of a minor character.
And what reasons do they give for these apparent failures of these African American units? Is it based on their racial inferiority, is it all based on essentially, racial prejudice, which is obviously very, very prevalent in America or large sections of America during the early 20th century?
Yeah, it's very much rooted in the Jim Crow, the pseudo-scientific nonsense, the racist prejudices that characterize American politics, American society, and of course, the American military. They are African Americans are regarded after the war as being inferior. They are seen as cowards, incompetent. There is a report that is commissioned by the U.S. Army War College in 1925, an infamous report that listeners can find and read online, but it makes for pretty difficult. And the conclusion there is that African Americans, they're okay as laborers, but as anything else, totally inferior, and that they shouldn't really be employed in the U.S. Army going forward. Certainly not in the technical branches like the engineers, the artillery, and
And how do people actually in the unit reflect on, I suppose, on this prejudice, which they've suffered for many, many parts of their lives, but also their experience in France? Do you actually get a large number of sort of personal stories which you can actually draw on, to illustrate their experience and their story in the front line?
oh yeah, absolutely. Sort of tracing what happens to the black officers and men of the battalion after the war is quite revealing. And it took me quite some time to sort of find these intricate snippets of information and to put them together. I mean, I could give you one just one example very quickly. J. Alvin Jones is commissioned as a second lieutenant shortly before the battalion set sails for France in June of 1918. Now, Jones already was a college graduate. He had some experience in electrical engineering sort of practices. And when they arrive in France, the battalion, along with the rest of the are able to see a country in, French society that seems far more open and far less racially hostile than the United States. Of course, France is not colorblind at the time, but for many African American servicemen, this is what's something to strive for. Unfortunately, the American High Command doesn't see it like that, and they are particularly concerned that African American soldiers are able to socialize with French civilians, and in particular, they're very worried about interracial relationships between African American servicemen and white French women. And unfortunately, J. Alvin Jones doesn't actually see combat because in August he's forced to resign his commission, and he's returned back to the States. He's an unfortunate victim, one of countless unfortunate victims of a rape hysteria that grips the American Expeditionary Forces. And this is a deliberately orchestrated attempt by the Americans to spread unfounded rumors and allegations that black soldiers were raping French women. It was bogus. It was, a huge injustice. But unfortunately, J. Alvin Jones is caught up in this. Now, obviously embittered by that experience, after the war, he decides to enter. He de decides to pursue a career in politics. He gets a law degree from Chicago, and eventually he works his way up to becoming only the second African American elected to the Maryland Senate. In the late 1950s, the only black senator in a southern state at that time. And he's not the only one who channels his experiences pursuing careers that advance or certainly aim to advance the plight of African Americans within American society in the first half of the 20th.
And so, coming towards the end, what's the historiography of this unit? Have people actually looked at the 325th Field Signal Battalion in detail? Or is it like much of the First World War in America, largely neglected?
Yeah, I suppose one of the reasons why I wanted to look, why I sort of switched my focus from the American, sorry, from the British Army to the American Army is there's very little written about the American Army. That's not to say there's nothing. There is a growing wave of scholarship coming out now, certainly over recent years, that's begun re-examining the AEF's military operations. But the communications angle is neglected, and obviously that's a reflection of the fact that. For Americans, for most Americans, World War One isn't very is a conflict that is sandwiched, if you like, between two much more important conflicts. That, of course, being the U.S. Civil War and World War Two. The Americans, of course, joined the First World War late. They only really become active on the Western Front from sort of the spring, the early summer of 1918 onwards, and so. In American historiography, World War One doesn't play a prominent role. So it's understandable that a unit like the 325th Field Signal Battalion, which when you look at it, is only about 430, 440 strong. It's understandable that there hasn't really been anything or any real attempt to sort of examine the battalions.
I suppose one of those questions that all historians should ask is, are there any key insights or lessons that readers can draw about the experiences of the 325th Field Signal Battalion in regard, I suppose, to racial equality and military service?
I suppose it's a case study that reinforces, I suppose, the very obvious fact that this has been a very long, bloody, and painful struggle, which is still being played out. One might perhaps make links to, the Black Lives Matter movement in years, and the continued problems within American society, within American politics, and that with regards to race. More specifically, with regards to the military, I suppose, in many ways, you could argue that armies are very much political constructions, that they are reflective of The views, the prejudices, the politics of the state itself. And I suppose the 325th Field Signal Battalion case provides a lens, if you like, a historical lens, can perhaps better understand the roots, the beginnings of the modern Black civil rights movement. How a dedicated group of specialist African American soldiers fought against what was essentially state-sponsored violence. It was enshrined in U.S. politics, in U.S. Society, within the military. But this group of African American soldiers fought against that, and in the process, in their resilience, their dedication, their determination, they make an important, albeit a rather subtle, contribution to what is termed the long civil rights movement.
And finally, Ryan, where can people learn more about your writings on this very interesting subject?
Well, you can read all about it. The article was published in the February 2024 issue of Historical Research, which is the Institute of Historical Research's flagship journal. And the bonus for listeners is that this is open access. My article is free to read, so it doesn't hide behind a paywall.
And on that bombshell, Brian, thank you very much for your time.
You have been listening to the Mentioned in Dispatches podcast from the Western Front Association with me, Tom Thorpe. Thank you for all my guests for appearing on this edition. The theme music for this podcast was George Butterworth's The Banks of Green Willow. It was performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Krish Russman, and produced by Biz Records. This recording is part of a collection of orchestral works by Butterworth performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales and supported by the Western Front Association. This is available from all good record stores under the record code BIS 2195. Until next time.